and welcome back to Spinalcast. I'm your host, David Stevens, and joining us today is Dr. Marina Martinez. Dr. Martinez is associate professor in the Department of Neurosciences at the University of Montreal in Montreal, Canada. Dr. Martinez, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So today's episode, I think what we're really hoping to do is give our audience a little bit of insight into the work that you do and the field of spinal cord injury research, as well as kind of get your perspective on the status of research in the SCI space and on, you know, kind of a global scale. And if that sounds all right to you, I think we could just jump straight into some questions.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. So first and foremost, why spinal cord injury research? What brought you to SCI in the first place?
Well, there is probably a couple of reasons that really drew me into this field. First off, I think when I was studying neuroscience during my master, I was in neuroscience and in psychology at first, but during my master in neuroscience, I became very interested by the brain's ability to reward and change after different kind of injuries and experience and so on. Mm-hmm. And I was really amazed by the brain ability to change and adapt to different conditions.
Yeah.
Then I started thinking about spinal cord injury and how much more complicated it was, because it's one of the hardest challenges for the nervous system, like to change itself and rewire. And then, I mean, for me, it started from then, but the second reason was that when I was still a master's student, I went to a conference and I had the opportunity to meet with researcher on spinal cord injury and also patients struggling with spinal cord injury. And what really stuck me was that despite all the research and progress that have been done so far, there was no cure.
Right.
So it really hit me hard seeing that these people were struggling with so much mobility challenges and so on. That's when I knew that I had to be part at some point of the solution and do research on this field.
Oh, that's great. I like that, you know, it was kind of a first hands-on experience that kind of drove you. And then I could also see as a researcher being kind of presented with something that's such a major open book that hasn't been solved yet is probably appealing as well. You know, giving you something to strive for that I don't know, maybe other fields also have big mysteries that haven't been solved yet, but I imagine this was kind of a major one as far as neuroscience is concerned. So
yeah,
that's awesome. So I guess when we're talking about your research projects and, you know, determining what it is you're going to work on next, how do you really kind of go about picking a project that you want to, you know, dive into?
Well, it's a really good question, actually. First, what I'm doing is I look for gaps
okay.
in literature. I look what is not been done first. But it's not just about science. I think it's also about what really people need.
Okay.
So what do they need and how can we help?
Yeah.
So a lot of times I trust my gut feeling for designing some research projects. So it's not about just like, you know, be pleasant for funding agencies, but really what I trust more. And I think like for me, for many people with spinal cord injury, being able to walk and it's a priority. So for me, focusing on motor control has always been central to my work. Mm-hmm. And I really starting by studying at first the basic science beyond recovery process. And based on that, we try to design strategies like rehabilitation approach, paradigms, and neurostimulation approach eventually really meet those needs.
Got it. So really, your approach to research is less about I suppose you're also including questions that haven't been answered, but really you're looking for it to be applicable to someone currently, and something that can actually help and move the needle forward, not just, you know, theoretical, kind of exploration.
Yeah, it's both. It's basic mechanisms beyond that, because we need the mechanisms, like the understanding, to move forward to design like therapies.
Right.
But I always see what are the needs and what people need. And I try then to understand better what the mechanisms are and then design the therapies based on those mechanisms. So we have like this line of studies in my lab. So mechanistic and more translational studies.
I like that kind of approach where you're kind of starting with the need and drawing backwards versus here's something that has me really interested, but I don't really know if I can apply it, towards making a difference. And so I kind of like the almost working backwards in a sense. I like that a lot. So to my knowledge, MCPF has kind of assisted in funding a couple of your projects in the past, one of which, I think the first one was in 2019. I was wondering if you would be able to kind of provide a little bit of detail around what that project was, kind of what the outcomes were, the results, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I've been funded by the Mortal Cure Paralysis Fund for many years right now. So it's really, I really appreciate that.
Well, we're happy to do it.
I mean, so at the first project that was supported by Mortal Cure Paralysis Fund was a project that we started at first in rodents.
Okay.
So give me a little bit of background so that you can understand what the technology was at first.
Yeah.
So when you walk, you probably know that your brain will send information down to the spinal cord to generate muscle contractions.
Okay.
But the brain is really the key, like the master of your voluntary control of movement. So you need that to be able to control, like, and take a cup of coffee, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that after the spinal cord injury, this communication between the brain and the spinal cord is interrupted, either partially or completely, leading to paralysis.
Right.
So it's like our approach was to basically not target the spinal cord or nerves, like below the lesion, but instead targeting the brain.
Okay.
And targeting the brain in a way that we could retrain the brain and relearn the brain how to take secondary pathways to then reach the spinal cord.
Mm.
And how we did that was to basically stimulate the brain
mm-hmm.
during movement intention. And we started doing that in a rat model where we send stimulation to the brain when the animal was attempting to walk. So they couldn't walk, but you still have some, you know, intention
okay.
to walk. So we detected those and then we stimulated the brain at the right time and in synchrony with desired leg movements. And when we did that, actually, it was fascinated to see that the animal could perform some steps
mm.
and to walk again during those stimulation. And it started from them. But the big problem here, the huge thing is that to take this technology to real world, I mean, you cannot go from rodents to humans,
right? That's a big jump, yeah.
In between. So we needed to test it in larger animal models.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I decided to apply to Mortal Cure Paralysis Fund grant. And we proposed a project where we basically stimulated the brain in large animal model that really mimic what happened in clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning that we had like this contusion model. So we have a weight like the dropping on the spinal cord and you have big lesion like in human.
Okay.
And you can create and mimic some paraplegia in animals. So, I mean, we started from them and the results were very, very promising. I mean, we got the proof of principle by delivering brain stimulation that you can actually alleviate deficits quite immediately after spinal cord injury using brain stimulation.
Interesting.
So you need residual pathways, of course. Like it will not work with complete spinal cord injury, but still it was the proof of principle that it could work in different animal models and with different lesion severities, like larger lesions, like like in humans.
Right.
So it was the first project that was funded by the Mozart Cure Paralysis Fund.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, if you thought of, say, a spinal cord as like a power cable in a home where there's a green line for ground, you know, your black line that carries the electricity and your white line that carries electricity. The idea being, let's say two of those wires got cut. Theoretically, if we stimulate the brain at the right time, we can get those two wires to actually travel down the white wire and continue to provide everything that they need to provide,
yeah,
but without all three of the wires, right?
That, yeah, kind of you can actually mimic what the brain would send normally to the spinal cord to control movement.
Okay.
This is the way we did it, is to provide electrical stimulation to the brain at the right time and right place in the brain to be able to support those movements that are lost after spinal cord injury. So the brain will actually be able to provide those inputs to the spinal cord through secondary roads.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a bridge. It's really using those roads that it doesn't usually take.
Right.
In that case, it's able to do it.
It's like redirecting traffic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Absolutely. So how are you able to identify what sort of stimulation is required for that? Like, do you do tests on normal people to see how their brains, like when you're moving, this is what your brain is doing, so we just need to copy paste that? Or is it different for everybody, or how does that work?
Well, we did a couple of years of testing before we were able to find the good, the magic sauce, mm-hmm, for that. I mean, it's a question of duration of stimulation, frequency, the right timing. It's really complicated.
Yeah.
To mimic what the brains would send normally to the spinal cord. So that's why we do mechanistic studies before.
Okay.
Putting those animals into physical training and therapies. So it took a couple of years to be able to design those strategies because we had to control and test different ways to deliver stimulation, mm-hmm, before we find the magic sauce and say, wow, the animal is able to walk. It's not like it's very, very tough because it involves a lot of time and students to be able to do that. But at the end of the day, reproducing what the brain or the spinal cord's function is very complicated because,
right,
it's a very intricate network of millions of nerves,
totally,
that work together and talk together. So we needed to do a lot of mechanistic studies before we reached the point of getting that magic sauce and apply it to different animal models.
Right. So after, this project kind of, I don't know if it was ever completed. I'm sure you're still doing some work on it in different facets. But, when you kind of achieve some results, I'm assuming you publish those in some way. And how have those affected, other research around the world in regards to spinal cord injury? Have your findings really kind of changed the game for people?
Well, I cannot say that. I mean, there is no one study that will magically change the way spinal cord injury research works.
Right.
I believe that this work opened up new possibilities for how we approach treating spinal cord injuries.
Mm.
There are many established paths for, try to improve motor functions such as physical therapy, rehabilitation. But to me, an exciting emerging field is really neurostimulation and neuroprosthetics, mm-hmm, meaning that device that interface with the nervous system to replace or restore motor function or sensory function or other function.
And if I'm correct, that's similar to kind of Dr. Cortin and Block from Switzerland, correct?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. We interviewed them in a past episode as well.
Yeah. The difference is that Dr. Cortin is stimulating the spinal cord.
Okay.
Right. So we have a different approach. We are targeting the brain, mm-hmm, and in Switzerland, they are targeting the spinal cord. So it's kind of a different,
yeah,
way to do it. And I think, like, you know, so far, most research have targeted the peripheral nerves, muscles, and spinal cord. And what makes our approach different is that we are targeting the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite new in the field. Like, some people were targeting also subcortical structure, like deep brain stimulation and something like this. But it was quite new to, you know, choose a region that was so far of the spinal cord. Like, right. You know, tapping into the spinal cord was well known. We knew that it could improve autonomic function, motor function, sensory function at some point, but it's still, you know, it's still evolving. But targeting the brain was kind of new. So I think our research has helped expand the conversation about how, you know, we can treat spinal cord injury.
Right. And do you, when you guys are working on your projects, I'm assuming you're pretty tuned in with other projects around the world in the SCI space. I'm assuming taking some knowledge from their findings as well to kind of help correlate where you need to go moving forward. And that kind of leads into my next question, which is really kind of like, how has that research progressed up to now? You know, I know it started in 2019, but, you know, I'm assuming today things have kind of shifted or changed a little bit.
Yeah, since then, like, it's been like, five years from now that we did this work. We have taken some major steps. So everything takes time, mm-hmm. for sure. But we patented the technology. So we protected the intellectual property, and we launched a company to be able to eventually move forward and be closer to clinical use. Right now, we are focused on getting the regulatory approvals from Health Canada, mm-hmm. to be able to start the first in human using this technology, so neurostimulation of the brain. And at the same time, of course, we continue all the time to secure funding to keep this research moving, like ongoing, and be able to test other solutions as well. There is not one solution, but many approaches that can be used, you know, in conjunction or not with brain stimulation.
Right.
So we are dealing with that right now.
Okay, very cool. And this actually, I have a question that kind of goes back in time a little bit to earlier in our discussion, but it just popped back into my head. When you are talking about stimulating the brain as a method of treatment for spinal cord injury, is there a correlation between how much improvement is received and how recently they've been injured? Did you notice correlations? Like if we got in there right away, we had much better results than someone like Peter Morton, our executive director, who's been paralyzed for 20 plus years. Were you able to find correlations there, or is this solution proving to be pretty successful across the map?
That's an excellent question. Because we don't know currently, like, the knowledge of, you know, the time window during which we have to do some therapies or physical training is not known at all.
Mm.
We don't know what's best. And we have an ongoing study in the lab looking at that. What if we provide stimulation acutely after spinal cord injury, or, you know, chronically, mm-hmm. like in the chronic phase? And it's not clear. I mean, what we found in rats, though it's not in humans,
yeah.
it's in rats, is that brain stimulation helps at any stage.
Okay.
But it looks much more efficient in the acute stage, meaning that you will have a really big increase in motor performance when you deliver stimulation acutely after spinal cord injury.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it's not really the translation is very, very tough, because usually patients need to rest for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
And rats, you don't need that, right? 1 week after spinal cord injury, you can start the therapies and they can walk.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the case in human. So we need to take into account that it will be different in animal models, and the translation will be difficult for humans. But I do believe that, you know, you don't want to go to invasive stimulation at first after a spinal cord injury.
Right.
You need to take the time to do physical training and see how the body adapts to that mm-hmm. before going to invasive solution. So I do believe that probably this kind of therapies or neurostimulation strategy like neuroprosthetics could not be approached like others. You need to take some time to be able to see if you can plateau in terms of motor performance before you choose to go to, you know, surgeries
right.
to implant, you know, some devices into your nervous system. So I don't have the answer yet, but I do believe that the sooner, the better for everything.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, that question's a tricky one too, right? Because if you're going to test, you know, any of these trials, and they need to be tested so extensively. And if you're trying to test if its efficacy is still there 20 years from now, you have to wait 20 years to do that test. It's not like you can just say, oh, well, we're going to put this rat in a time machine and, you know, 30 minutes from now, he'll be 20 years older. That's just not how that works. And so I can see how that is a very tricky point in that research cycle. So thank you for the answer to that. Let's talk about a more recent project then, if you're willing to shift gears here. It's so MCPF founded another project that you put together in 2023. I'm wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit more about that one.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, we were first founded to test cortical stimulation, so brain stimulation. And but even though the results were very promising, there is not only one, you know, mm-hmm. solution for treating motor disorders. So I do believe that multi-level, you know, stimulation could eventually help as well, and especially for personalization of treatments. So what we decided to put together is to use two established techniques, so brain stimulation, mm-hmm. that we used before, and also peripheral nerve stimulation. So using peripheral nerve stimulation, we tap into sensory nerves of the limb, and we can generate reflexes using that.
Yep. I think I've experienced that before with just, you know, doing like stim recovery kind of things.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the thing. So you tap into the spinal reflexes to generate movements. And we decided to combine those different strategies, so brain stimulation and peripheral nerve, to be able to see if you could maximize motor output after spinal cord injury. So we tested this combined approach in large animal models, and the goal was to see if there was a synergetic effect mm-hmm. between the two and if we could personalize those treatments to any individual. And it was actually exciting to see that each strategy was efficient to basically assist movements immediately or in long term after spinal cord injury. But they do so in different ways. When you use peripheral nerve stimulation, you tap directly into spinal reflexes, so you can give immediate assistance, movement assistance, mm-hmm. and you can help start rehabilitation. It's almost like you give a quick boost to the spinal cord, so it helps, you know, increasing the excitability of the spinal cord. And on the other end, when you use brain stimulation, you have a more gradual effect, meaning that it helps to create movement patterns, and over time, with the rehabilitation, you can restore voluntary control of movement. So it's very complementary at some point, because you can use peripheral nerve stimulation at first and then start using brain stimulation to rewire the pathways to be able to promote long-term recovery. So that was very exciting. And what was more exciting to me is that when you combine the two, you can really personalize the treatment to very large and severe lesions.
Mm.
So the animals that were completely paraplegic at first, when you design some specific settings and you provide specific settings to the nerves or brain, you can basically maximize motor output and alleviate some asymmetrical deficits, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is no lesion that is perfectly symmetrical. So you'll have deficits that are different between the left and the right side, and you need to tackle that.
Yeah.
And using those approach, you can nicely tackle those deficits and using different settings for each stimulation source.
Yeah.
So this is what we found, but the project is still ongoing. We got a continuation and renewal of this grant. So we are still pursuing on this project right now.
I just can't imagine how many variations of different stimulations there has to be for all the various, you know, muscles and movements and everything. And everything has to have its own little tweaks and bobs. So I can see how it's taking a while. I think you kind of answered the question I had in that last answer, but I'll still ask it to see if you want to go into more depth. But, you know, when you're talking about electrical stimulation and getting movement returning, especially voluntary movement, you know, I'm imagining that the way that it's being presented by the brain to the spinal cord and then to the muscles, naturally, for someone who's not injured, that all happens without any sort of thought, right? And it just happens quickly and easily. But with stimulation, is there relearning that has to be done where the brain says, in order to do this, I have to achieve this sort of stimulation from the device and then put it out to the leg? Or is the body's knowledge of voluntary movement helpful in getting the stimulation to work properly? I guess, is my question making sense? Like, does pre-existing knowledge play a role in this, or do you have to relearn everything?
I think it's an excellent question, and it's probably both. I mean, the body knows how to compensate, usually, right? Naturally, you'll have some recovery process, spontaneous recovery process going on. When you do an injury, you will have some a learning curve at some point, and you will have some improvements, naturally. What we do with stimulation is that we boost this natural process.
Yeah.
We boost it, and also we foster some mechanisms that would not occur naturally. You know, so some mechanisms that we call plasticity, so the rewiring of the, you know, the pathways, this is something that we can boost with neurostimulation combined with rehabilitation. Nothing happens without any physical training, right? So you need to combine those with rehabilitation. But I think that almost all the time, I mean, when you break something into your body, the body learns how to compensate.
Right.
Compensation, I think that compensation is different from true recovery.
Yes.
It's completely different. Like, you can compensate because you have a cast and, you know, you know how to deal with that by compensating with the other leg or other hand. But having a true recovery means that you'll need to recruit the pathways that are meaningful in the nervous system. So, and this is what we try to do with neurostimulation, is to put the system in a way like to mimic what happens normally in the system,
right?
Basically.
Very interesting. Cool. So kind of switching gears a little bit away from yourself then, what other kind of research around the world has you kind of excited or interested, you know, looking in, or even that you're kind of taking notes from at this time? I know you mentioned earlier, you know, we talked about Cortin and Bloch and their targeting of the spinal cord with stimulation. But what other stuff is out there that you have interest in?
Oh, that's a really tough question, though, because there is so much exciting thing going on in the spinal cord injury research right now. I think we are lucky because we live in a time of rapid technological advancement right now. It's really cool, and it makes everything feel even more thrilling, I think. But personally, I'm most excited about research that brings different fields together. Medical engineering, neuroscience, artificial intelligence, and so on. And when we combine those areas, we can create the next generation of devices and treatments in ways that we couldn't do it if we were working in isolation. So I think that collaboration across disciplines will be key, and will foster probably research in the spinal cord, in the spinal cord injury field. I'm very excited by the research focusing on assisting, replacing, or, you know, preserving lost function when it's done in a way that's collaborative to me.
Yeah.
So there is so much going on. I mean, neurostimulation, I'm very interested by neurostimulation and neuroprosthetic, of course, but I think that there will not be a single way, you know, to treat motor disorders. You'll need to put together different treatments like drugs, neurostimulation, physical therapy, and it will be personalized. I mean, everyone is different.
Right.
So you need to personalize this treatment based on the needs and on the deficits of each individual, which make it very difficult at some point.
Well, and that kind of keys back to, you know, talking about artificial intelligence. I could absolutely see a use case for artificial intelligence in which it's taking the inputs and outputs of your stimulation device and actually taking into account the reaction that it's getting out of the brain and saying, I'm going to learn. And as this person's body strengthens and they start learning, they're, you know, more of these pathways are developed, I'm going to tone back how much I'm stimulating so that they're, you know, building muscles more or creating more strength there. And so, you know, it starts, like, if you could develop it so you implant it and it will learn along with the person, then all of a sudden you're extending how long they can really get benefit from the device.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an ongoing research as well, using artificial intelligence algorithm that are able to optimize the setting, the stimulation setting in real time.
Right.
So this is what we have like been done in the past in collaboration with many researchers at the University of Montreal to be able to basically, because I mean, doing that, it's doing this optimization manually is impossible. I mean, there is so many stimulation settings that you'll need to parameter that at some point, because it's so complicated. So you need those new algorithms and machine learning algorithms to do it for you.
Right.
And it works well, actually. And they are able to learn and to get feedback from the nervous system to be able to say, okay, you need to stimulate at this frequency, duration, at this location. And it takes 2 minutes and for a person, it will take months.
Right.
To do the same thing, right? So it's very exciting because it opens up possibilities like to, you know, minimize the time.
Right.
To be able to do those settings. I mean, if you want to go to clinic, nobody will buy a device that takes 1 hour to set. It's too long.
Totally.
You need to have this optimization that would be quick to be able to offer a solution that is not like drastically impeding the whole system and practitioners, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the future is now, and that's what's got me excited. You know, the idea that all of these tools, technologies, and groundbreaking research is all being able to kind of apply with one another to really provide, you know, a difference in those suffering SCI injuries. Let's talk about kind of challenges that are facing SCI research. I know in the past we've talked to a lot of different researchers and people living with SCI, but what are some of the challenges you think are facing the research right now?
There are still many challenges for research in the field, for many fields. I mean, I think the first one to me is really the complexity of the spinal cord itself. We don't have a full grasp of the mechanisms, and the spinal cord is incredibly intricate. I mean, the network, you know, control everything from movement to sensation, autonomic function. So it's a very complicated network, and we need to do some mechanistic studies.
Yeah,
still continue mechanistic studies for developing effective treatments. I think another challenge, a big one, is to be able to translate animal research to human treatments.
Mm.
It takes a lot of time. And even if you have promising results in animal models, moving from animal to humans takes time, takes funding, And it's not because it works in animal models that it will work in humans, right?
Right.
So it's not directly applicable to humans. So we need to work hard for the safety first.
Absolutely.
And effectiveness. So it's something that takes like probably around 20 years when you have a really good solution. Moving from animals to humans takes some time because you need to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand what's going on in humans as well. Of course, like everyone, I would say funding.
Yeah, yep.
Funding is a big deal, right? It's even more a big deal for translational studies because it's not easy, but it's much easier to get funded for mechanistic studies and clinical studies than translational.
Yeah.
Because you are in between mechanisms and clinical. So there is usually a gap of funding between mechanistic and clinical, translational. So we need to be very motivated to be able to be funded for such studies. But this research is actually like is essential. We need to do those to be able to perform some clinical trials.
Absolutely.
But it's difficult to be funded.
It takes both to really have success in the long run. Just one or the other wouldn't really get us the outcome that we're looking for.
Exactly.
So I think you're totally right there. All right, one more question for you, and then I'll let you go, Dr. Martinez. You know, as someone who might be watching this podcast, who might be interested in the studies of neuroscience or you know, getting into some sort of role like you, would you have any advice that you'd give to somebody who's, you know, headed down that road?
Yeah, I mean, spinal cord injury research is very exciting and is very, like, you need to be passionate. And my biggest advice would be to stay curious and open-minded. I think that there is a lot that we don't know yet, right?
Right.
And I would approach it with a sense of exploration and also be willing to question everything. I would also say that don't be afraid to fail.
Absolutely.
Because this kind of research, like every research, is full of setbacks. It's often disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
You fail a lot of time. But those failures, probably, it's from those failures that we learn the most.
Yeah.
I've been learning from my, you know, those failures. And resilience is key. But I think that probably to me, what I would put at the core, and it's to keep the patient at the core of your research. I mean, it's really easy to get lost in science, the data, and, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But do not forget that you're here to help real people with real needs, right?
Yeah.
This is why we work. So it's really what motivates me every single day when I fail sometime during my research. I always think about what I could eventually provide at some point for people struggling with spinal cord injury. So that would be my small advices for people or students who would like to enroll those this very interesting field of research.
Awesome. I love that answer and really appreciate it. You know, I think that's all the questions that I had for you today. I do want to say on behalf of everybody here at MCPF, you know, thanks for joining us, but really thank you more so for your tireless efforts in working towards a cure for paralysis. And it's truly inspiring. So we thank you for all that you do, truly.
And thank you so much for your support.
Oh, of course. Of course. I do want to do one quick shout out. Anybody who's at home watching this on YouTube, we'd love it if you gave us a subscribe, a like, hit the bell icon so you know when new episodes drop. If you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, you could always give us a follow, and that's appreciated as well. But yeah, thanks again, Dr. Martinez. It's been an absolute pleasure, and hopefully we'll talk again sometime soon.
I hope so.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.